Shrink Wrap Radio number 598, Exploring Indigenous Healing Psychology, with Dr. Richard Katz.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Richard Katz, a Harvard-trained clinical psychologist who has spent the past 50 years working with Indigenous elders and healers in various parts of the world and has published the culmination of that work in a book titled Indigenous Healing Psychology, Honoring the Wisdom of the First Peoples. For more information about Richard Katz, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Richard Katz, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, it's really good to be here, David. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good to have you. We've just been chatting for a while before me turning on the camera here and having sort of a bonding experience, which which feels good. It's so good to have you on the show and have you here to discuss your work. And I had a sense as I was going through your book that we share similar values and outlooks, and I really got that sense was reinforced as we were just chatting. And my work is strongly influenced by humanistic psychology and the human potential movement and a broad conception of psychology and psychotherapy. And I sense a similar, a fellow spirit in you in that regard. So when and how, first of all, let me show since we do have a video as well as an audio audience, I'll show your book, this wonderful book that you've written. It's a reasonably thick tome.
Reasonably thick.
Yeah, really. It's 458 pages all the way to the back, and it's Indigenous Healing Psychology, Honoring the Wisdom of the First Peoples. And when I saw that title, I thought, wow, this is going to be very interesting to me and to my audience. When did you first become interested in the wisdom of Indigenous peoples?
Yeah, I just wanted to say first, David, that I said I was glad to be here, but I'm particularly glad because, as we talked about before, I'm so happy to talk to another psychologist and someone who is grounded in some of the values that I share and explores, because that's really how I came into this whole Indigenous thing, that I was trained at Harvard as a clinical psychologist. And somehow there was something always missing. Although, as you saw in the book, I did have a rather unique graduate training because I was involved with Leary and Alpert in their psychedelic explorations.
Yeah.
So that convinced me, as well as meeting with people like Maslow and Erickson and Murray, that there was really something more. But I have to confess, David, I didn't know where to find it.
Right.
Certainly the psychedelic drugs were of great interest, but not a path, and it's not my path.
Yeah.
Again, not being critical, because nowadays there's a lot of research reaffirming what we found out in the 60s, that some of that material is very good for end-of-the-life issues, for crisis issues, for heavy depression and things like that. But
yeah,
it wasn't my path. So
yeah,
here I am, a postdoc student, and a person by the name of Richard Lee, who was an anthropologist, met me in the hallway and said to me, literally, "Dick, I know you're interested in these other stuff. You know, how about coming with me to the Kalahari to work with the Bushmen?"
Wow.
I had no idea. I had no idea what he was talking about. Why not? I thought, you know, this is part of my nature. And that trip, which was in 1968, where I saw among hunting-gathering people, Bushmen people, Xuntla people, living a life of healing and community cohesion, and seeing the altered, enhanced state come right into daily life, that changed my life.
Wow.
And from that point on, I saw that in Indigenous teachings, those things I was looking for, we talked before about something more, Well, for me, that was the answer. Now, I have done meditation and I still do yoga, but in the indigenous world and the privilege that I've had being in that at different times, I see it all happening. Now, this is not to say that it's ideal, romantically wonderful. It's just like the non-indigenous world. There's problems, issues of controversy, but there are paths that you see, holistic paths. You know what I'm talking about, like the humanistic psychology really lived out in a community.
Yeah.
And when I saw that, David, I just said, this is it.
Well, I'm glad you balanced it out, you know, with underscoring so that we don't over-romanticize, because
exactly.
There's always that pull, you know, that so it sounds like you found a balance, and probably you work to keep that balance, I would guess.
Well, you know, the thing is this, David, that I live now in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, work mostly with First Nations people. And I have to say that the issues that beset that community are much more severe than one would ever want, whether it be suicide, drug, substance abuse. Not everybody, obviously, but it plagues the community.
Yeah.
So we're not talking about, as you say, some idealistic, some romantic thing. But within that community, there are the sweat lodges, there are the ceremonies, there is the commitment to living a life of spirituality. And one of the beautiful things, and I talk about that in the book, is it's a spirituality that psychology could really learn from, because it's a spirituality of everyday life.
Yeah.
Part of the problem with Abe Maslow, maybe we could agree on this, was that he emphasized too much peak experiences.
Mm-hmm.
In my life, I've had peak experiences, but spirituality for me is an everyday thing. I look outside, right, David, and I see like the trees are coming out now, the buds and then the leaves. That's spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
The wind talks. Mm-hmm. These are the kind of things that in indigenous communities you see all the time.
Yeah.
The river is alive. You see? That's pretty simple.
Right.
And so I think that psychology could learn so much from indigenous teachings and not be afraid of it. Like, again, spirituality is just, hey, being in balance and greeting your...
Yeah. One of the ideas that recurs in your book is the notion of countercurrents. I like that expression. It's not one that was at the top of my consciousness. So you talk about the countercurrents that have influenced indigenous life, the impact of colonialism, for example, that has been so destructive, and the really some of the bad effects of the impact of the West on these other cultures. So those countercurrents to the spiritual tradition that these cultures have, and their attempts to rediscover it, refine it, preserve it, etc. So that was fascinating. And where was I going with this?
Yeah, I think the other thing, David, is about, you know, because here we are, two psychologists talking to each other, and I know that out there, a lot of people that hear your show are probably into psychology or some form of it. And again, you know, I chose psychology because it's all over the place, right?
Yeah.
Not just as practitioners, but as consumers. And one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is one of the things I was taught in terms of indigenous teaching is acceptance. So I'm trying in the book not to put psychology down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not my purpose. My purpose would be to say, and I'll tell you a little story that's in the book. So the man I work with, who's my spiritual father as well as my best friend, he tells a story. His name is Danny Muspa. He tells a story that's in the book of his great-grandfather was on the reserve when the priests first came.
Hmm.
And, of course, the sweat lodge and all the ceremonies were the work of the devil, right? Well, there was one priest that came to his great-grandfather, who was a sweat holder, and said, you know, I'm really interested in this sweat lodge, but I'm afraid of it. I'm afraid that I'll lose my priesthood. I will somehow be working against what I've been taught. And his great-grandfather said, don't worry. He said, you'll come into the sweat as a priest. You'll leave the sweat as a priest. but I think maybe a better priest. Mm-hmm. And yeah. to me, that was so important because psychology has a lot to offer. And I don't think it should be closed to indigenous teachings out of fear that they're going to lose something.
Yeah.
I think rather it's to be enhanced psychology.
Well, I think in many quarters that is happening. It brings me back to the countercurrents. I think that's where I was going to go, yeah. was that you do, towards the end of the book, you underscore that there are countercurrents within the larger enterprise of psychology. And I wanted you kind of talk about the history of psychology a little bit, and its devotion to science, its struggling to be a science like physics or chemistry or, you know, a natural science that you could really nail down some facts. And a kind of deification, in a way, of science that I, for a while, was an exchange professor at the University of New Hampshire. And the chair of the department was a fairly famous psychologist, and he invited my wife and I to dinner. And on the wall in his home, he had a plaque, or it may have even been what do you call it when you write things with thread and a stitching thing?
Yeah.
It was a quote from, I think, John Galton saying, basically, if you can't measure it, it's not real.
That's right.
This is where other people have a thing that says home sweet home
or something.
He's got that on his wall.
Yeah.
You know, that,
yeah.
Whoa, that was, he made it clear what his take and position was on psychology. Yeah. And so do you see, and I think I know the answer to this, but do you see science as the only legitimate way of knowing?
Well, you know, I'm so happy you brought that up because I still teach. That's the only, well, you know how wonderful teaching is. You did it for many, many years. And one of the things that, and I teach indigenous students, that's my work, you know.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they'll often write in a paper is indigenous approaches, because I ask them to compare indigenous psychology with mainstream psychology. And one of the things they'll sometimes say is indigenous psychology is good even though it's not scientific. And I tell them, when you write your paper, promise me one thing, that you'll remember that indigenous approaches have their own science, right? and so never say that indigenous approaches are good except not scientific. And the beautiful thing about the indigenous approach to science is that it's only real if you can measure it, is the experimental paradigm, which you and I both went through.
Yep.
No matter how humanistic we are, psychologists out there, no matter how humanistic you are, you're always thinking on the back of your shoulder, there's someone tapping you. Can you measure it?
Yeah.
In any case, from an indigenous point of view, the most important data is one story. Now, this is a beautiful challenge because, for example, you come out of the sweat lodge or you're talking to someone, you're telling your story. Nobody can say, hey, David, that's not what happened. No. It's your story.
Yeah, it's your story.
And so it's the ultimate data. Now, the beautiful thing about it is being ultimate data, and I would argue very empirical, it's impossible to measure. What you do is you listen. So it's a whole different way of doing science that's equally respectable, equally careful, but doesn't require measurement.
Yeah.
And so there are these paths. And from an indigenous point of view, if I tell you my story, let's say we're an indigenous community together, that's it. You don't say to me, Dick, well, wait a minute, can I ask you this? Wasn't the event that way?
Mm-hmm.
Because my story can also change. And that doesn't make it invalid because I've changed.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned yoga, and I was involved with yoga for a long while. And people had talked about the science of yoga, you know, and that sounded like, well, you know, the PhD part says the science, you know.
Yeah.
But what you have is people making careful observations.
Exactly.
Going into the inner world.
Yeah.
And it turns out that people from different traditions, often there are points of agreement.
That's right.
Among the careful observers of the inner world.
Yeah. What I'm really hoping in terms of this book is to talk about a bunch of psychologies.
Yeah, right.
Different psychologies that can work together.
Right.
But, the thing that's so interesting about ways of doing research, okay, I'm going to work with a thing called the Regional Psych Center, which is a place up here in Saskatoon. It's a prison, but for people who have psychological issues, right? And they have what they call knowledge keepers working there. That is, people doing sweats for the inmates, as well as psychiatrists, psychologists, CBT, cognitive behavioral, a whole range of things, medical doctors. And in that workshop, what I'm going to try to do is to say each discipline has its own protocol. Like knowledge keepers, indigenous healers have a very strong protocol. Mm-hmm. A strong learning experience, totally different than the psychologist, but to be respected because each of them work hard at their protocol. And so what I'm trying to do is to allow people to respect each other's discipline, not to join it, but respect it because each of them are working hard from their own set of assumptions, honoring their own protocol, working their own history. And that's kind of like the model I'd like to see because, hey, listen, there's a lot of people out there hurting and suffering.
Yeah.
Psychologists should never worry about losing clients.
Yeah, that's kind of the model I try to come from in this show is to make it as diverse as I can. In our chat earlier, I did share that I do have limits, but I do try to be as broad-minded as I can.
You know what the thing is, David, for me?
What?
If I meet someone of integrity, where they're coming from and what they're offering, I'll listen.
Yeah. I want to go back to ways of knowing, legitimate ways of knowing, and I wanted to push you a little bit to ask if you believe in any form of extrasensory knowing, if you will.
Oh, totally.
Totally, okay.
My first book was called Boiling Energy. No, actually, you know what my first book was? Preludes to Growth.
Preludes to Growth.
And it was out of that experiential movement, remember?
Yeah.
It was called Preludes to Growth, an Experiential Approach. The first review of it was Preludes to Growth, an Experimental Approach.
Uh-huh.
People were unwilling to talk about experiential, so they translated it. I put him on a tree limb. Uh-huh. I said to him, my boy, the tree is alive. It has a spirit. If you want to sleep on the branch, it'll take care of you. Now, I said that, David, not, just I believe it.
Yeah.
The tree has a spirit. And he put his head down on the branch, closed his eyes, and took a little nap.
How old is he?
He's 4.
Yeah, that's a precious age.
You know what I'm saying? So these things happen all the time. And I've had experiences, I used to work with a, way back with a woman that traveled, space travel. And I used to be her ground control so that she could go off into space. Mm. And at one point we said, wonder whether this thing is, you want to come along? Sure. And I went along and we tested out. We were on two sides, either sides of a building. And she said to me, what's on my side of the building? Well, let me take a peek around. Da-da-da-da-da. Oh, yeah, that's what it is. You want to come on my side? Take a peek around. Uh-huh. Now, I mentioned that, David, not because that's how I work, but again, these things are not extraordinary. When you travel with, for example, the Zhentua, they climb the threads of God's to God's village. Uh-huh. To try to rescue the sick person. Now, when I got back from that in 1968, they said, what threads? Did you measure them? Seriously? Did you measure the threads? Boiling energy when the body heats up. Did you have a this is serious. The first question someone, did you have a thermometer? You don't measure psychic heat.
Yeah.
You feel it.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, David, I don't lead with those conversations because it suggests to people something, wow, when really it's actually right in front of us. Mm-hmm. I told my little grandson, I said, I want you to look carefully at this tree. What do you see? It was just a bud. And then I took him another part of the tree. What do you see? A little green coming out. I took him another part of the tree. What is he? A leaf. I said, my son, this is how life goes. It's out of the world, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's right in the world.
Now, you were trained as a clinical psychologist, so presumably the idea of becoming a therapist.
That's right.
Did you, I'm trying to remember, in the book you kind of discussed that. I think the impression I left with was that you did not become a professional psychotherapist.
Yeah. Now, actually my training, and I'll bet you had the same thing at Michigan. I was trained to do research to show that psychotherapy doesn't work. You understand? That was what my training was in clinical psychology. But I've never set up a practice. Hey, David, I've always worked either in an institution or doing counseling as my, part of my teaching job. I have a lot of respect for people that do clinical work full time. I don't think I could do it because it's hard for me to earn my living that way. But I totally respect people who can do it and who do it in a good way. But I'll just tell you, we all know that sometimes the pressures can be adding clients because we need to make more money. That's kind of hard. That's when it gets difficult.
Yeah.
But personally, I've never worked in private practice, but I have a lot of respect for many of the people that do that who really work hard.
I'm guessing that all the experience that you've had with the indigenous people and being privy to their ceremonies and their ways of thinking and healing, that somehow you're bringing that into your teaching and your counseling as part of
all the time.
Yeah, as part of your role.
And you know,
it's really
like
part of
word,
who you are. Yeah,
yeah. That word privy, I like that. Privilege too. Mm-hmm. I want to be sure that anybody that picks up that book knows that the teachings that were passed on to me, and these elders said, please do this work, write this book, that those teachings come from grounds of suffering. The people who have those teachings are not well off economically, politically, a lot of difficulties. So those are teachings that were earned through suffering.
Yeah.
And they're passed on in the book, not to say you have to suffer to read that, but hopefully when people read the book, they get the idea that all those teachings are meant to help us serve better, to serve others. That's a big teaching.
Yeah.
Serve others, yeah.
One of the sections that I was intrigued by was you're wrestling with, and I'm sure other people wrestle with this, okay, who deserves to be called an elder? Who deserves to be called a healer? And that there are, because of the impact of colonialism and the other isms of the West, there are such people living not on reservations, but in the cities.
Absolutely.
In various parts of the world.
Yep.
And with all the regular stuff of people who live in the cities.
Yeah.
many of the afflictions, as you point out, often worse because of the destructive force of loss of culture, loss of history, alcoholism, drug addiction, and so on. And somehow in the midst of all of that, there are people who deservedly lay claim to elderhood or healing, being a healing person or a shamanic person. Talk a bit about that.
I just want to first reemphasize the very important phrase you had, loss of history. It's almost inconceivable for many of us to understand what that means.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you brought that up because that's one of the things. Loss of history means loss of identity, loss of sense of self.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the urban area, you're absolutely right, David. A lot of the elders I worked with now are in the urban area. And again, leading life that with all the same challenges as most urban people. part of the difficulty is that the non-Indigenous community now seeking the help of Indigenous elders, for example, to start a meeting with a prayer, to maybe offer a sweat lodge, the criteria that they, the non-Indigenous world, uses to pick an elder is not usually or often the criteria that was used historically. Historically, the criteria was the community. You see, I lived in Fiji for 3 years, and there was a guy there that became involved with the church, you know, born again. And I remember sitting outside as he was doing a ceremony, and the guy said to me, "This is nonsense. We know who this guy is. We've known him since he's been a baby. This is BS. This is not real." So in a community context, historically, they knew who the elders were. They knew who was to be trusted. They knew who had the knowledge. In an urban area, it becomes much more confused. Traditionally, elders had people speak on their behalf. The elders would never talk about their own power. They had a spokesman. In the urban area, they have to promote themselves more. So it's very confusing. I find, you know what I find? I have certain bottom lines. No inappropriate behavior, because that still goes on. No charging money. A certain personality. I like a person who's humble, who's straightforward. And I triangulate. You know what I'm saying? What do you think of him? What have you heard about him?
Right.
But the main thing I would say to people who might be listening who want to work with an elder, please don't pick the first elder that comes into your view. Oftentimes the first elder that comes into your view is the one you don't want to work with because they have the time to come into your view. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so elder is not just about age.
And it's not just about age, but I find, just personally, hey, David, I don't work with people who are very young. Although the difference is there are some people out there who are healers, and that can happen at a very young age. But the elders are more like people whose life experience makes them. And the other thing about elders is there's a lot of older people who have years and years of experience, but not a lot of self-reflection on that experience. I don't work with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very small group.
Yeah.
And you know what else, Dave? I have to work with someone I like. Personality, we have to have to mesh.
When you say work with, I'm not sure we know what you mean by work with.
It's a full range of things. So first of all, it might be the person I go to sweats with. I might give talks. I always try it whenever I give talks about these topics to travel with an elder. I might ask them to do a naming ceremony for one of my kids. I visit with them. We do work together. It could be all different things. Help them with healings. It's a full range of things.
Yeah. You know, I want to pick up on the money issue that you mentioned because there are people these days that, and I know some, and have affection for some even, who are making a lot of money by leading people to Peru to be involved in shamanic ceremonies and so on, and to become certified in the process themselves somehow as having. So let's kick that one around a little bit.
No, I love your question. You know why? Because clearly you have someone or people in mind who you like very much.
Yeah.
And I want to respect that. And I have to tell you that I'm not sure what to think of it. And I would think of it only on a case-by-case basis. Now, in a generic way, in a general way, I think I would want to avoid an entrepreneurial approach. You know what I'm saying? Trying to make a lot of money from this.
Yeah.
On the other hand, hey, listen, I went to the Kalahari on a grant. You know, I'm not just some person who magically discovered the way. I'm part of that in a sense, right? I went on a grant. So I think it's the way it's done that's most important. Like there are people all over the world with knowledge to share.
Yeah.
But I want to say there was a time, Maria Sabrina, did you ever remember that name? She was, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
She was in the psychedelic era, was doing ceremonies in Mexico. And she wrote, she said, you know, and a lot of people used to go down there, New Age thing. She said, you know, this is a little bit ridiculous. I'm paraphrasing. These people are coming down there to find God, to find their spiritual center. I don't know what to do with them because we use these substances to heal people. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? That's the dilemma.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I have to be very honest. I search in places like that for knowledge. So I would never kind of say, oh, you can't do that. It depends so much on the exact nature of it. And I would say, you see, right now, for example, when I have elders, I pay them, but I don't pay them an honorarium. I give them a gift of money.
Mm-hmm.
You see, because traditionally, the elders and the healers were taken care of by their community. The work and the time they spent on healing, people would bring them food, people would look after them because they didn't have time. And I give, like, for example, in my teaching at the university, there's a fund for honorarium for elders, which I never draw on. I always use my own money. And the reason is because I want it to be a gift, not an honorarium.
Mm-hmm.
So these trips down there, I'm so glad you asked that question because it is a very important question. And I don't think anybody should quickly make a judgment, yes or no.
Yeah, yeah.
And totally on the person. And for example, what's the sharing with the people down there? Right?
Right, right.
If the person organizing the trip is making $1,000 and the people down there are making $10, I don't think I could go for it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, hey, David, if the guys down there are making $1,000, how do you share that? You don't give it to the one person. You see, in this book that we're talking about, the royalties are going back to the people.
Yeah, I was struck by that. That's,
but you know something, David? Not to one person that I work
right.
with.
Right, sure.
Community.
Yeah. Yeah, you probably know Stanley Krippner.
Oh, yeah, very well.
Yeah, yeah. So I put a version of that question to him about somebody that we both knew.
I know. Yeah,
And Stanley's a very interesting person, as you know.
Oh, he's special.
Yeah. So he said, well, you know, this person has, he said, the proof of the pudding is, do they have a community?
That's
right. Do they have
right.
a community that recognizes them and, yeah, basically recognizes them.
That's right.
And,
yeah.
And so that was kind of a big criterion. And,
in the case we were talking about,
it was true.
We need access. Hey, David, like if you said, hey, let's go to Peru, you and I, I wouldn't have any idea how to get there to meet these people. So there's a role for those who can connect you and I to the people there.
Uh-huh. Okay? Interesting. Yeah.
The question is, are they serving the larger good? Or are they serving their own entrepreneurial?
Yeah. Yeah, good.
And then down there, Stan is absolutely right. There are people now emerging all over the world, some of them quite young, offering their services. They do know something, but they're not part of their community. They're already striking out on their own in an entrepreneurial way. So you have to be careful.
Yeah, yeah. There are a lot of issues to weigh around that because, you know, there are people in my local community who probably have that same impulse maybe that we had when we said, oh, yeah, a psychotherapist. Yeah, I'd like to do that. That sounds like a good way to be helpful to people. But these are people, there are people who are holding themselves out as shamans. You know, Caucasian Western people.
I know.
But they've gone to various trainings and so on, and now they're holding themselves out. And, you know, I haven't looked into it, any particular cases with deeply enough to make an evaluation of it in general. But it's one of the cross currents that's happening right now.
Absolutely. You know, David, I'm always trying to be really careful because, you know, it's so easy to talk to you as if I were different. Just look at me. You people can see. This is who I am, a white person. I'm not a shaman. I've worked with indigenous healers for over 50 years, but I'm very careful to say, and even though I have ceremonies that have been given to me, I'm not an indigenous healer. And I wrote that book not to describe indigenous psychology, but to offer to psychology, mainstream Western psychology, both the providers and the consumers, because listen, we're all consuming it, a different perspective. Mm-hmm. It's not a book on indigenous psychology. And I think I have to be very clear, because people are very eager to put you in that position as if you are part of that world. I am part of the world. I've lived there on and off for 50 years, but I'm not of the world.
Yeah, you've mentioned two groups. You've mentioned First Peoples there in Canada and the Kalahari Bushmen. And I think there were, what, five or six different groups?
Fiji, Alaska, and Rosebud Reservation. And I mean, I guess I'm kind of, I'll share this with you. I'm a Sagittarius. See, I believe in astrology as a study, as a serious study. Huh. Sagittarius is, they like to travel. And I'm in that class, I love to go to different places and learn, but I have to always be very clear, I'm not a practitioner. I talk to people about this, and if they really want to go, for example, to a sweat, I can direct them where to go.
How do you overcome suspicion of the indigenous people? How do you gain their acceptance?
Sometimes never. When I first moved up here to, see, it's a different thing. I went to the Kalahari. Very few white people had been there. No problem. I went to Fiji, the island I lived on. I was the only white person there. No problem. Back here, with all the years of contact between indigenous cultures and white mainstream cultures, a lot of issues have been built up. It's not easy up here. And I remember the first time that I went to sweats up here, some of the young guys were looking at me, not saying it, but looking at me, what the F is this white guy doing here?
Yeah.
I accepted. What I was doing there was I was invited by the elder to come to his sweat. I was part of his family. But there's the resistance. So I'm always very cognizant of that.
I had two students who were Lakota Sioux, and they invited me to go to North Dakota, to the community there, and where they still do the the ceremony where they put hooks in the
Sundance.
It's the Sundance ceremony. There were a lot of reasons probably why I didn't do it, but at some level I think I was chicken to face what I thought would be hostility.
Yes.
You know, what are you doing here? Who do you think you are? So I didn't go. It's the path not taken. I can kind of wonder about that.
Well, I think if you don't meet hostility in today's world, you're not really there. But who invites you is the key.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The sweat holder is the one that invited me.
Yeah.
That's who I go to. These other young people were also invited to go to the sweat. But they have no right to tell someone else they don't belong there.
Since you've made many references here to the Sweat Lodge, can you talk to us about the meaning of the sweat to you and sort of what you experience and why evidently this is?
My first sweat was with Joe Eagle Elk at Rosebud in the late 60s. I think I've probably gone to, I don't know, 300, 400, 500, who knows? Lots.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something. It's easy to go to a sweat and forget the reason you're going there. there's a kind of an ethos, the hotter the sweat, the better. We went to a really hot sweat. That's ridiculous. The teaching I got is the sweat is for prayer, not for burning people. It's for prayer. Mm-hmm. But I can go to a sweat, especially when I was younger. Oh, the macho, you know, going to a hot sweat, I'm surviving.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. Now, when I go to the sweat, it's for prayer. I pray for people.
Uh-huh.
Pray for their health. Pray for their well-being. I've been taught, hey, David, I never pray for myself.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's service. So the sweat lodge, for me, is a place of prayer. And that's how I've been taught about it. Not a place to show how brave you are to go the heat. It's not a macho thing. But that's that undercurrent.
Yeah, that... Yeah, I think there is
it's that undercurrent of that. And I'll tell you something. Now I will be very clear, okay?
Yeah.
Not the Peru thing, but this will be... Sweats never should cost anything. Oh, don't say it out there. Someone's out there saying that. But, you know, I feel very strongly about that because I know that's a tradition. Now, let me make a little footnote. When some of the elders here are asked to put on a sweat, for, let's say, the police service or for some agency, they get an honorarium. Okay?
Yeah.
They are given something for their time, but not to make money, eh, David? For their time.
So it's interesting that there in Saskatchewan, that there is a kind of merging of the two worlds, right? That the white people are saying, come and do this for us. Give us this little piece of cultural experience.
I like that phrase. Give us this little piece of cultural experience. It's like, it's not even the icing on the cake, eh, David? It's like a little tidbit. Mm. I think that if you really want to learn about something that's going on, you spend the time.
Yeah.
You go to ceremonies. You do things that involve some sacrifice. Because right now, for example, elders are being asked to open ceremonies, like, say, a meeting, a town meeting, or a school board meeting. So they sit like this, eh? You know, give their prayer. Then they kind of, they're off stage. The meeting is over, a prayer at the end. That's nothing. You know what I'm saying? That's window dressing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, well, you're
like prayers in Congress, I think. And
that's right. It's exactly what
those,
it's like.
Those are window dressing, right?
It's what it's like. And yeah. See, you're in an area where probably people are offering sweats for money. California is notorious for that.
Yeah, I haven't encountered it, but I'm not out much.
I see on the internet sometime.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And also, it's just, again, I don't mean to criticize anyone that's listening, but my teaching has always been that the sweat lodge are for prayer and for service. If someone is going to ask for contributions, because it does take effort, you know, to put on the sweat, to get the rocks and so forth, that's a whole different thing. Could you help me out? Because I spent a day putting the sweat lodge on, mm-hmm. but not to charge people. And again, I don't mean to offend anybody that's listening. It's just the teaching that I've gotten.
Yeah. Do you find it to be a bonding experience with?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally. You're in there, David. You know. You're in. Have you been in a sweat?
Yes, but not a official one.
Yeah, you're in there, and you're on a journey, and you hear people's prayer. You know, I go to the sweat sometimes, David, and I could cry. You know, the things that people are experiencing, the difficulties, and they're seeking the Creator's help. And we sing songs and we pray. And it's powerful. It's a powerful experience. And when you come out, you're all part of the same family.
Mm-hmm.
I've had some wonderful experiences with my kids in the sweat. You see?
Yeah. How many kids do you have?
Four.
Four. I have four kids.
Yeah. It's wonderful, huh? And grandchildren?
We're going on number six any day now.
It's not a special part, eh?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. They should rewrite the whole theory of development. You know, Erickson had eight stages, right? He forgot that stage that comes in when you become a grandfather or grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
and it's a return to the energy of the earlier stages, right? Mm. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know about Erickson's ninth stage, right?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so. At least not that name.
This is a beautiful thing, you see, because Erickson changed. That's what I loved about him.
Yeah. Now, you knew him, right?
Yeah.
For our audience, you know, you got to hang out with a lot of heavy-duty people in psychology.
Well, it was my good fortune. You know, Henry Murray, and Skinner was there, and Bruner.
Abraham Maslow.
Maslow. But Erickson's have a ninth stage now.
Yeah.
Which they came up with when they themselves were old. And they looked back on their lives and said, you know something? There's a ninth stage, which is reflecting back on all the stages and reworking them all.
Mm.
Beautiful, huh? Mm-hmm. And then the other thing they said, which was, I think, so beautiful, they want to change the relationship between each stage. So it's not trust versus mistrust. It's mistrust versus trust. Their point being that overcoming obstacles is a more challenging thing than coming towards possibility. And only as you get older do you see that.
Yeah. That puts me in mind of some of your discussion going back to the idea of who's an elder. And it was you had a beautiful line in there about the sort of universal need for reflection. For self-reflection and for reflection on the meaning of life, what's it all about?
Yeah.
And that the elder, one of the true tests of the elder is somebody who is really taken that very seriously and spent a lot of time in that place.
An elder to me, in terms of, you know, not an old person, but an elder, is not someone who's lived a long life, but someone who's lived a long life and has learned from it. through reflection.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, and then the other part of it I think is so important is that one of the things the book is talking about is that the mystery remains. You know, psychology, and I think it suffers from a thing that, I don't know what you'd call it, but conviction that if we only refine our experimental procedures, we'll discover everything.
Yeah.
From an indigenous point of view, the mystery remains.
Yeah, I love that you're talking about the mystery. A psychologist friend that I had lunch with said, David, you keep interviewing Jungians, you know? What's all this stuff about Jungians?
Yeah.
And my reply was, well, they honor the mystery.
The mystery, this is a beautiful thing about Jung. I know, I'm very attracted to that part of it, yeah?
Uh-huh.
The mystery remains.
Yeah.
And the beautiful thing is, it's not something to be seen as a failure. We can't finally get to the core. But it's a sign of respect. How could we possibly think that we could know it all?
Right, right.
You know, I mean, I look at, you know, there's a guy in Portugal, I can't remember his name now, but he sent me a manuscript. It was called The Book of Ignorance. And what it is, hey David, is what it is it's a story, it's an allegory, a guru who's talking to his disciples and they want to know. And he spends all his time talking about what he doesn't know.
Huh. Yeah.
I thought that was powerful.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea.
But I don't know. We don't know. Like, you and I are talking here. I wish you good health and I'm sure you wish me good health.
Yeah.
But literally, we don't know the next moment in our lives.
Well,
and that's the way it should be, I think.
Mm-hmm. When you said the Book of Ignorance, I had a flash of a thought, well, maybe that's what all books are.
Well, you know something? I like that. The book that I wrote is as far as I could go. And what's left is an enormous amount.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned 400 and whatever pages.
Yeah.
Once I started, David, I couldn't stop.
How long did it you know, I think it's a remarkable book. How long did it take you to, because you put so much into it.
Well, that's my seventh book, David.
Wow.
It takes about 10 years for each book.
10 years for each book. Wow.
Roughly.
Yeah. Let's see. You started when you were one.
My first book was prenatal.
Yeah. I had a whole bunch of questions to ask you, but I like everything that we've covered, and I don't think we need to talk about the questions that I had. Well, maybe so.
You know something? I have to tell you, I love that question about Peru. I love it because, for me, it comes from a place in you of vulnerability. Uh-huh. That clearly you're fond of people that do this.
Yeah.
And so to ask that question to me is very important because you've become vulnerable to me because I know you have a connection. Mm-hmm. And I can be honest, you know, with you without hurting your feelings because you asked me that. So I really appreciate that question. That's the kind of question that I love because it comes from a place of integrity, you see.
And I feel vulnerable putting it out there because what if my friend hears this?
No, that's what I'm saying, yeah. But you see, if it's a real friend, hey, David, all they can have is respect because you're taking a risk. Mm-hmm.
Good. I hope so.
And if they don't have respect, David, then you have to question, hey, listen, how deep is our friendship? And I mean that seriously because, like, you're not supposed to take without question what your friends do. It doesn't mean you disagree or you think it's wrong, but you can question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, just to give you a quick thing, the village I lived in Fiji has now become a place where they're digging for gold. What's going to happen to that whole place there?
Disaster.
Yeah, disaster. But some people will go to that village for healings. Am I going to say that the people I work with now have become evil? You see what I'm saying? Things change.
Right.
And so we have to be very respectful. I try to be respectful of everybody that I meet who has integrity, no matter what they offer.
Yeah.
And that becomes hard sometimes, as we know.
Yeah. Would you say that is something that you learned through your experiences with indigenous peoples, or is it a quality of personality, character that you started out with?
No, I was raised to be very judgmental, David. Uh-huh. And I still have that strong trait in me. But the years I've spent with indigenous people, indigenous cultures, I just kept on being told acceptance. I don't have to say what you're doing is good. I don't have to support you. Acceptance means you're another human being. Carl Rogers had a beautiful thing in one of his papers. He was talking about supervising his interns, and they were talking with sexual predators and pedophiles, and they said they were really frightened to accept them, to get into their world, to have empathy, because would they be tainted by that? And Rogers said, what you have to do is you have to accept, because what these people need to hear is that you can relate to them as a human being. You're saying to them, by traveling with them, you're still part of the human race. Mm-hmm. You don't have to like what they're doing. You don't have to support it, but you respect the fact this is a human being, flawed, disturbed, evil even, but a human being. And that's acceptance.
Yeah.
I'm far from that.
Well, I wrestle with that too. Very much, yeah.
You know something? It's easier to judge.
Yeah.
It's easier to judge because as we judge, we put ourselves up.
That was one of the things that I shared with you before we went on air, that I was initially felt alienated from the psychoanalytic perspective as I received it at the University of Michigan. And it was the sense that everything was pathology.
Yeah.
You know, kind of the opposite of respect.
That's right.
We all have these gradations of pathology. If you're not this,
and
you're
again,
that.
To say to the psychologist that are listening, we don't have to work from a position of authority and power. we can work from a position of respect and acceptance and be much more effective. That's what indigenous healers are not working from power. They're working from mutual respect.
That might be a good place for us to wrap this,
okay,
this up.
Okay, yeah. Well, this is it's a wonderful visit with you. And
likewise.
I really enjoyed this, yeah.
Yeah, me too. Maybe I'll come up and we can do a sweat.
You're always welcome.
Okay.
If you can, I say that to California people, but the only condition, you have to come up in the winter. We have minus 40.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and
I mean centigrade rather, minus 40 centigrade.
So the reason you have to come up in the winter is what, to
it's just
to prove that you're really
suffer.
Okay.
I'm just kidding.
Okay.
Okay. Well.
Okay. Well, Dr. Richard Katz, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yeah. Thanks very much, David.
As you could tell from the interview, Dr. Katz and I got on famously. In some ways, it felt like we were cut from the same mold. He received his doctorate from Harvard in 1965. I finished mine in 1970 from the University of Michigan, although I was done with classes a year or two earlier. So we were both academic children of the 60s, if you will. We both experienced psychedelics, and both were strongly influenced by experiential approaches to learning. And, of course, another commonality is we both studied to be therapists, but ended up with teaching as the centerpiece of our careers. If you go ahead and read his book, which I strongly recommend, you'll learn quite a bit about his personal journey, and the early chapters focus on his years at Harvard and his sense of being an outsider. In some ways, it occurs to me now that his life path led him to become something of a professional outsider, that is, devoting 50 years to the study of indigenous groups, where he would always be an outsider, no matter how much he was able to gain their confidence. His graduate experience was different than mine, inasmuch as he worked under and with some of the real movers and shakers of the time, including Timothy Leary, Richard Alpert, who later became Ram Dass, and others associated with that group. He became friends with Abraham Maslow and mentors Eric Erickson and Henry Murray. He also mentions David Raisman, B.F. Skinner, David McClellan, Elliot Aronson, and Jerome Bruner, among others, a virtual who's who of psychology in the mid-60s and later. As we chatted before I turned on the recorder, we discovered that we know quite a few people in common, and I even learned to my surprise that he had given a presentation to the Depth Psychology Master's Program at Sonoma State University, where I taught for so many years, just a year or so ago. Unfortunately, I didn't know about that, and I missed the opportunity to meet him then. The thing that impresses me most about Dr. Katz is that he really walks the walk. I'm sure that came across to you as well. I'm impressed that he has pledged all the money that the book earns to organizations supporting indigenous peoples. I'm also impressed by the care he takes not to speak ill of people or organizations he has no direct experience of. Although I'm not sure he would claim the title, I think he really embodies the honorific title of elder, not so much because of his age, but because of the thoughtful, self-examining wisdom he's worked for and earned over the years.
Hi, this is Kathy O'Canna calling. I am calling to express my gratitude for all of the effort that you have put into providing weekly thought-provoking podcasts. One of your interviews mentioned that Western medicine provides numerous diagnoses and very little in the way of healing underlying trauma. I am hoping that we are entering into an age where people refuse to treat their symptoms by pharmacological means, whether medically or self-prescribed. Knowing that there is no one approach to healing that will be effective for everyone, I encourage people to listen to your podcasts to help them discover approaches which resonate with them so they can begin their own journey towards healing. While on the couch with Dr. Dave, I have found myself paying greater attention to my dreams, practicing yoga more frequently, shifting my priorities to allow myself time to care for myself, increasing my attempts to remain in the present, renewing my interest in fairy tales, mythology, and the tarot, and mustering the courage to work on my marriage in a more constructive way. I believe that it is easier to stay angry and blame others than to acknowledge our own roles in relationships and take responsibility for our own hurtful words and actions, which may be sabotaging our ability to connect and forgive others. I have recently begun somatic experiencing therapy to assist my body in letting go of the trauma that it holds. Dr. Dave, your podcasts have significantly inspired my personal journey towards healing, and in an effort to encourage others to do the same, my husband and I feel we must financially support your endeavor. Dr. Dave, as you have been called to provide people with windows into a wide variety of approaches to healing, I believe that those of us who are listening are being called to donate what we can to further the healing of others. Thank you.
Wow. How synchronistic that Kathy O'Connor's endorsement is paired with this interview with Dr. Richard Katz. The two are totally complementary. Kathy and her husband, Dr. Michael O'Connor, are longtime supporters of Shrink Wrap Radio. If you're not already a donor, won't you please join them? Again, I want to thank all those others of you who have stood by this podcast over the years. And in that vein, I want to thank the latest person to sign up as a financial contributor, Jane Brewster. Thank you, Jane. And thanks again to today's guest, Dr. Richard Katz, for such a genuine encounter and for giving us a taste of his 50 years of respectful work with Indigenous peoples. I do have an interview lined up for next week, but I'm trying to reschedule to open up some time in my own schedule to prepare for a television interview regarding my work on profiling the infamous Zodiac serial killer. So until next time, whenever that is, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.